Terry Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. In this segment of our program, the mass destruction of Iraq, and who's responsible, and why. From Seattle, Washington, Dar Jamal, he has become a world-renowned investigative journalist for documenting the human cost of the Iraq war and the growing misery in the lives of Iraqi citizens. In 2003, frustrated with media reporting on the Middle East by embedded journalists, Dar went to Iraq to report on the realities of the war himself, hence becoming one of the very few independent journalists in the country. He also reported from Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan. He has been a journalist for Al Jazeera's Human Rights Department and was its online news producer based in Qatar. His stories appear in Truthout, Tom Dispatch, The Guardian, La Mode, The Nation, and other progressive news outlets. He's received many prestigious awards, including the Martha Gellhorn Award for Journalism, the James Aronson Award for Social Justice, the Joe Calloway Award for Civic Courage, and four Project Censored Awards. Dar's written several books. His most recent, co-authored with William Rivers Pitt, is The Mass Destruction of Iraq, The Disintegration of a Nation, Why It Happened, and Who's Responsible. His website is daharjamail.net. Nice to have you with us today, Dar.
Thanks very much for having me, Gary.
It'll be 11 years this March since the U.S. launched its invasion on Iraq to oust Saddam Hussein and his secularist Ba'athist government. During that time, I think we can look back and identify three main periods which generally outlined the disintegration of Iraq: life under Saddam Hussein prior to the U.S. invasion, life during the U.S. occupation and the restructuring of the country under Maliki, and finally life following the departure of the U.S. military and the Iraqi descent into sectarian violence and the rise of the extreme radical militant factions such as the Islamic State. According to Iraq body count, there have been 12,618 killed as of yesterday. 1,500 were by Iraqi government forces. Now, during your last visit to Iraq a year ago, Iraqis were saying how life then is far worse than it was under Saddam Hussein. And the U.S., known for raising dictatorial leaders into political positions, simply replaced one of its dictators, Saddam Hussein, for another, Nouri al-Maliki. At least during Hussein's regime, there was national unity and pride among three primary sectarian groups, Sunni, Shias, and Kurds. This has all disappeared now. So based upon your investigations and reporting from the Middle East, I'd like you to provide an overview of the collapse of order and a relatively stable, secure, and sustainable life that many Iraqis enjoyed, but not all, under Saddam Hussein, and then take us through these three periods. The forum is yours.
Thank you. Well, it's, again, under Saddam Hussein, as with life under any dictator across the Middle East, I mean, one thing you do have is security. I mean, you know where the red lines are, and this was the case in Iraq, where as long as you don't say anything negative about the government, you're probably going to largely be left alone. And that was the case in Iraq. It certainly wasn't a great way to live, but at least there was security and predictability, and you know, that's why that was during a time, at least before the U.S. 91 war and then the ensuing sanctions, where Iraq had the best education in the Middle East, it was the best place for women's rights in the Middle East, the best health care, et cetera. But you know, again, beginning with U.S. involvement in 91 of bombing much of the infrastructure of the country and then the sanctions that killed over a million Iraqis between 91 and 2003, obviously life began to degrade rapidly. And then with the ensuing invasion in 2003 and ensuing occupation after that, the U.S. Immediately began fomenting sectarianism. And you know, a lot, I wrote about this early on, and other journalists have written about it as well, that by 2004, when it became clear that the U.S. began to lose control of the occupation, where we had them battling Muqtada al-Sadr and his massive Mahdi army Shia militia, on the one hand, and on the other hand, they had their hands full with Al-Anbar province, which is mostly Sunni, and a massive uprising there that was really very effective militarily against the U.S. occupation at times. And so what they did is they brought in John Negroponte and appointed him as ambassador, and then he brought in a retired Colonel James Steele to head up Iraqi security forces. And they brought in these two guys specifically because they were who Reagan used in Honduras during the 80s. Much of the 80s, Negroponte was Reagan's ambassador to Honduras. Of course, he's long since been called out by various human rights groups as being responsible for helping set up the death squads, the right-wing death squads down in that country and across Central America that killed tens of thousands of people. And also in the 80s, he worked with James Steele to set up and run the death squads then. So they literally regurgitated this policy, put these guys in Baghdad in late 04 and let them go to work. And so that is the genesis of the rampant sectarianism that we started to see from early 2005 going forwards to where, and that's really the heart of why 2006, 2007 in Iraq, the sectarianism was by far and away the leading cause of death. Thousands and thousands and thousands of Iraqis every month being killed by these sectarian death squads that were really set up and run as part of the divide and conquer strategy of the U.S. Empire Project. And the also around that time, the U.S. brought in Nouri al-Maliki, who was basically referred to as a Shia Saddam, where he also, this is well documented by Amnesty International, by Human Rights Watch, and other groups that had set up basically dungeons and torture facilities and secret prisons for going out and capturing Sunnis, and it was revenge time for the Shia. And so that, of course, dumped more fuel on the fire that I just described. And that was basically the situation ongoing, where from that point on up until a couple of years ago, or even just a year ago, when it was so bad and there were so many human rights abuses happening across Sunni communities of Baghdad, but primarily across Al-Anbar, that the Sunnis started to demonstrate. And every Friday, they were going out and they were, alongside the Friday prayer, they were having demonstrations. And so, for example, I went to one of these demonstrations last year. They went out on the highway that connects Baghdad and Amman, Jordan, and right in front of Fallujah, they would have their Friday prayers, and then they would march out into the highway and have these massive, massive demonstrations. And what happened over all this time of Maliki's targeting of the Sunni population, coupled with them having been targeted under the U.S. occupation, where you have this large segment of young Sunni men that are completely disenfranchised, they had no political representation that was effective anyway in Baghdad, and they were just getting hammered by the Maliki security forces who were going into these neighborhoods and these cities and detaining people, torturing people, killing people, raping people, both men and women. And they had had enough, and so they were making very, very clear demands for their human rights to be respected and this kind of thing to the Maliki government, who, of course, not only ignored them, but then began killing unarmed protesters during these Friday demonstrations that were happening across much of Iraq. And so that basically further radicalized an already disenfranchised, angry, downtrodden young Sunni population, and that really, I think, set the stage for a group like Islamic State to come in and have a very fertile recruiting ground, because these guys, the Islamic State, very, very well armed, very well funded, thanks to U.S. policy, thanks to the GCC Wahhabi countries like Qatar and Saudi Arabia, who had done the brunt of the funding. And so when a group like ISIS was able to roll into Mosul, as they did, and just take the city, it's been so easy for ISIS to roll into these Sunni areas of Iraq and take control because they had a lot of sympathy from the people on the ground. All of a sudden now, there's this group that came in and chased out the government forces that had been persecuting the Sunnis for years. And so they were welcomed. Hey, we don't have to worry about that. Of course, it became quickly apparent that they basically switched one evil with another. And we, you know, anyone who's read much at all about the Islamic State can see, you know, this is a Frankenstein. This is a death cult. This is a group of radicals that are carrying out horrific things on a daily basis. But so just for context, though, that explains why this group has been so effective in parts of Iraq, because that's evidence of how bad these areas were suffering under the Maliki administration and thanks to U.S. support. And it's also why there's so much anti-Western sentiment, because literally everything the U.S. has done in Iraq for the vast majority of Iraqis has done nothing but made things worse. And this is, and now here we are at a state of really utter disintegration of a country where U.S. airstrikes both in Iraq and Syria are clearly only making matters worse. And now we have, you know, things coming apart at the seams. You know, we have almost 2,000 U.S. troops in the country, and this number will continue to increase. We have had over 300 airstrikes to date. That the Pentagon admits to. And ISIS has come out and said, look, this is the greatest recruiting tool you could do for us, so we don't mind these airstrikes. And this has always been the case with airstrikes. When the U.S. has been involved, is that they seem to only make matters on the ground worse for everyone, and not only not accomplish the objective of bringing these groups under control, but really drive more people into their ranks, as evidenced by the growing number of civilian casualties. So in a nutshell, that's really, I think, you know, an overall analysis of the situation on the ground and how we got there. So I think in short, we can say that, you know, the situation is in a state of total chaos and disintegration, and we can trace the vast majority of the reasons back to U.S. involvement through the decades in Iraq.
Dar, thank you for that insight. Aside from the U.S. invasion being based upon false pretenses and deceiving the American public and our legislators, what, in your estimation, has been the fundamental faults of U.S. policies with Iraq that have led to the crumbling of the country? And when we take a look at the Biden pact back in 2008, which called for a breakup of Iraq into three autonomous regions for Sunnis, Shias, and Kurds, do you believe that that is what is happening? What would happen if that strategy were actually to come about? Now, following that, I'd like for you to address the idea that we are talking about the coalition of the can-dos working together, as if these are our close and noble democratic allies, Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and I'm in Egypt, and I'm looking at these countries and I'm saying these are despotic regimes, these are dictator-driven regimes, there's no human rights, there's no freedoms for most of the people, certainly not women, and where it is a really tragedy that anyone should be murdered, let alone have their head decapitated. Saudi Arabia has decapitated between 19 to 29 people just since January. They've decapitated hundreds. They've never been criticized for it. And in some of these areas, women are regularly imprisoned or beaten for doing nothing that would be a breaking a law in any other civilized country. Why aren't we willing to acknowledge that these countries also have been funding the terrorists, training the terrorists, and they have their own agenda for why they would do that? Tell us that story, which we are not touching in the American media at all.
Those are all extremely important points, and starting with that one, I mean, it's you really laid it out clearly. These are, you know, the only, most of the countries the U.S. can get involved to help at this stage of the game in Iraq are these despotic, horrific countries. They're all Wahhabi states. You know, there's zero women's rights. People are decapitated in Saudi on a regular basis. They're rounded up and tortured and other horrible things done to them in other countries like Qatar and et cetera. And so it's really a situation where we look at now these airstrikes being carried out by these GCC countries, and even the prime minister of Iraq is against them because these are essentially Sunni Wahhabi states that he doesn't want this happening, because that goes against the grain for what is happening in Iran as well and their designs in Iraq. But it is amazing to me that if we look at these types of countries and their own policies against their own people, talking about Saudi, et cetera, and we look at the U.S., you know, still under the guise of doing this for democracy and human rights and freedom for the people of Iraq and Syria, which is a complete farce at this point. It's, the hypocrisy is amazing. I mean, think about it this way. What if Russia put together a coalition, a so-called coalition of countries that if they'd done the same thing so imagine some other countries that were the equivalent of Saudi Arabia, of how they treated their own people, of chopping their heads off and, you know, throwing black sheets over women and beating them up if they try to drive a car and this kind of thing. And these were the types of countries that Russia decided to gang up with and start conducting airstrikes across the Ukraine. Imagine how the U.S. government would play that and spin that in the media, and imagine how the mainstream media in this country would handle that. I mean, it would just be a light show circus on any given day about negative rhetoric against that kind of policy that Russia was carrying out. And yet look at what we're doing in Iraq, all under the guise and the propaganda of freedom and democracy, and we're trying to help the Iraqi people and save the Yazidis and all this kind of nonsense, which is a big farce. And that ties back into your previous point of, well, if the U.S. why is this happening? I think it's important that you brought up the Biden pact that he spoke of back in 2008, and there have been other references and some retired military generals who've spoken to this, of this idea of breaking Iraq up into three rump states, and there's even been some maps drawn up about that since 2005. Basically, a Shia stan in the southern part of the country, a Sunni stan kind of in the middle that's largely left without too much because there's not so much oil there, and then of course an independent Kurdistan in the north is generally how it would flake out. I mean, this goes into designs of what Israeli policy would like to see happen in Iraq, and it also goes into designs of how would be the easiest way to divide up Iraq to better control oil. And by design or not, because I personally would want a little bit more hard evidence of some documents that we can point to where these orders have been given. Unfortunately, to date, there's just been a lot of anecdotal evidence, but there's been enough that, you know, bottom line is this is what we see happening. I mean, we see Iraq now in a state of utter disintegration. There's no way it's going to hold together as a country. It's, you know, the North is already essentially operating on its own anyway, making oil contracts independent of what Baghdad wants or not. And the same with the South. I mean, we see, you know, that the largest oil fields in the country down in the Shia-dominated South, and they're basically being run by the Shia. And so, and the Sunnis at this point, you know, what's happening with the Islamic State, it certainly is another case of anecdotal evidence that, you know, however this flakes out, they're scrambling for oil. They have control of some oil fields in Syria. The U.S. has been bombing those. They're trying to gain control of water resources in parts of Iraq and some of the oil infrastructure there. And that's, I think, at this point, why really push the U.S. to the brink of, hey, we can't let them start getting their own oil, and because then they really would have enough economy to realize their own state, so we better get involved. And that's my read of why the U.S. decided to step things up this late in the game, despite the fact that, you know, they've known about the Islamic State for years because our policies have helped create it.
What are your views about the propaganda spin of terms coming from John Kerry and the State Department and the neocons that would want Americans and the world to believe that there is a difference between a moderate and an extreme rebel, for example, in Syria or in Libya, and that the U.S. will support the moderates as being the good guys and declare war on the extremists as the bad guys? And, of course, these categories are so arbitrary that they're nonsense, and a moderate today would be a far extremist tomorrow. And also in Libya and previously in Iraq, we had been funding people who said they were moderates, but turns out they weren't, and with Chalabi and others controlling the private contracts, and then private contractors coming in and then funding people. The money was in getting arms to people, training people, and without concern, who were these people ultimately going to fight? When you have 5,000 people a month that you're training at a base in Libya or in the desert, you're not identifying who's going to turn a weapon on a Sunni or a Shia or a Kurd or someone else in the future. And you're giving them state-of-the-art equipment. You're training them in explosives. You're training them in urban warfare. You're training them in assassinations. Some are being trained to be snipers. And then one day, we have a group of people who are taking advantage of what they have. Now, And we also are fully aware, because of international intelligence and monitoring of all communications, that the Saudis have been training extremists for a long time and far more than any other country in that area of the world, because they have more money, they have more of everything. Also, Saudi Arabia has 700 fighter planes, 700 jets, all right? They have the second largest air force in the Middle East behind Israel. They have enormous amounts of hundreds of billions total into their military complex, and yet we don't see them taking the lead and doing anything against ISIS on the ground, or only a token effort in the air. Now, you look at Bahrain, you look at Yemen, you look at Egypt, all of them have been supported by our military, all have been used for training terrorists. Now, they may have believed that these were like the Mujahideen in the 1980s in Afghanistan, fighting the Russians to get them out into the early 90s, but it didn't work out that way. Remember, one of those Mujahideen was bin Laden, so and a lot of other terrorists after that. So take us on that journey of the propaganda being put forth by Bill O'Reilly and others versus the reality that you are aware of.
Well, this is, I mean, gosh, you really covered it well. I mean, it's a situation where we couldn't have a better modern-day catch-22 if we tried. It's really, really amazing to me where, you know, the U.S. gets involved, basically hijacks the what began as a legitimate people's uprising in Syria as part of the Arab Spring against Bashar al-Assad, who, you know, people have had enough of these dictators across the Middle East. The U.S. took advantage, saw the possibilities of this, took advantage of it, got involved, started regurgitating the same strategy that they used in Afghanistan, as you pointed out accurately, where, you know, under Reagan, which at the time was the largest covert U.S. Military operation to date, funding, arming, training the Mujahideen there. Ronald Reagan dedicated the first launch of the space shuttle to the so-called freedom fighters in Afghanistan and compared them to the founding fathers of this country. And then, of course, you know, when you train these guys, you know, they rushed the CIA in there, taught them how to make car bombs, taught them how to make suicide belts and vests and do suicide bombings and among other things. And then, of course, they created this monster that took it several decades. But, you know, the blowback, we all know how this story ends. There's always going to be blowback for these kinds of activities. We did the same thing in Syria. We found radical groups, rushed them in, you know, found people already existing on the ground who were willing to do our bidding. And as John Kerry himself said a few months ago, he said, hey, the most radical fighters in there, they're the best fighters, because they'll go to any lengths to get the job done. We know that. And that's why we're now forming these moderate groups. And it's amazing, because the U.S. created the radical fighters. And as you pointed out, the brunt of them are coming from places like Saudi, as is a lot of the funding is directly coming from Qatari and Saudi nationals. And that's basically how the U.S. is, you know, not given the money directly, but kind of funneled it through other countries and had other countries given them carte blanche to do the funding. And the U.S. has just provided a lot of the arms and some of the training and created this Frankenstein, you know, this very, very short-sighted policy of, okay, we've got these radical groups that are willing to put everything on the line and go after Bashar al-Assad. And they were doing the fighting there for a while, but at the same time, started, you know, several of them became warlords, and they started setting up their own areas of control in the country. And this is why, to date, Islamic State controls roughly a third of the petroleum infrastructure in Syria, and they've gotten stronger, and they started to become more autonomous, and you know, taking advantage of all this U.S. help to basically start to create their own Islamic State. And yet now the U.S. going in saying, okay, well, this has gotten a bit out of control. Our first Frankenstein's gotten out of control, so now we're going to go make another one, but we're going to call this one moderate. I mean, how are you going to go vet these guys? I mean, it's really a complete joke. Anyone that applies any logic to this U.S. policy will quickly see that it's about as short-sighted a policy as the same economic policy in this country, where literally any decisions in D.C. are being made only by the corporate puppeteers behind the scenes who their primary objective is, you know, our only concern is how do we increase profit margins for next quarter's earnings statement. That's basically what's dictating the entire U.S. economic policy. And I would argue, and that's how short-sighted it is, and I would argue that that's the amount of short-sightedness involved in U.S. policy.
Well, Dar, I agree with that. We're out of time, however. I want to thank you very much for all your good work and for coming on and sharing these insights. Jahar Jamil from Seattle is my guest. The website is daharjamil.net, and the book is The Mass Destruction of Iraq. I'm Gary Noel, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. Now let's shift gears. We're going to talk about the mass destruction of Afghanistan and why. And we're going to go to Norway for this part of our discussion. You've just been listening to Dar Jamil talk about his experience and his insights. Now we're going to speak with Dr. Ann Jones. She's a seasoned war journalist, investigative reporter, and a photographer and author of 8 books. Now translated into 10 languages. And she has reported from conflict zones in Afghanistan, where she was an embedded journalist, South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Her focus has been on the impact of America's wars upon civilians and American soldiers who fight our wars. Her most recent book is They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Return from America's Wars, The Untold Story, which was supported by a fellowship from Harvard University, and it paints a horrid picture of the dead, wounded, and mutilated, the brain damaged and the drug addicted, and the suicidal casualties within our military ranks and its effect on families and loved ones. Her articles frequently appear in The Nation and Tom Dispatch. She resides in Norway, and her website is annjonesonline.com. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
During the past 2 years, there have been reports of the deteriorating living conditions in Afghanistan. And according to a report published in Tolo News in Kabul earlier this year, 36% of Afghanis are living in poverty and 25% are unemployed. 30% lack food safety. On the plus side, it can be stated that education and housing and health services have improved, but this only after the devastation of the U.S. military assault to oust the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And unlike Iraq, which had a stable, secular, and upward mobile society under Saddam Hussein before the Bush administration's war, life under the Taliban was dismal, particularly for women. At least, if we believe in the official 9/11 argument that there was a rationale for invading Afghanistan, that was clearly not the case for Iraq, which was an invasion upon lies and propaganda. So based upon your time spent as a journalist in Afghanistan during the American occupation there and your continued contact with developments occurring in Afghanistan, please provide us with an overview of the living conditions for the average Afghani from the time of the Taliban rule prior to the U.S. invasion, the period during the height of the U.S. occupation, and conditions today. And also, would you say that life has improved or is worse for the Afghan population under the Taliban or the Karzai government?
That's a tall order. That's a very long question that demands a kind of long answer. I'll try to do that as briefly as I can. You have to remember that Afghanistan was a very poor country to start with. It was chiefly a nation of farmers. 85% of the population were rural farmers, with a few cities. It was pretty well pre-destroyed before the United States invaded it, because we had, with our allies, so-called Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, supplied the funding to wage a proxy war against the Soviet Union during the 80s. So that had taken a big toll on Afghanistan's living conditions already. And then when the Soviets pulled out, we did a little more damage, as much as we could, by encouraging the Islamist extremists, whom we had been backing in the war, to go ahead and try to take out the government that the Soviets left behind, which was, incidentally, a very popular government that Afghans in Kabul, anyway, look back to with great nostalgia these days. And then we abandoned the country as well, and there was a prolonged civil war, which did more terrible damage to the country. So at the time we went in, as Rumsfeld himself complained, there was hardly anything left to bomb because we were bombing a pre-destroyed country. Since that time, with massive amounts of assistance from the international community, things have improved, and at least in the cities. Certainly, Kabul has a great deal of new construction, and some of the other major cities the same. But a lot of those fancy buildings in Kabul have been built on the strength of government corruption and the drug trade. So it's hard to tell how much is due to humanitarian assistance and how much is due to local bad enterprise. So people in, many people in the cities probably live a little bit better than they did, although even as I say that, I doubt it at the same time. And many Afghans are saying now that life is worse now than it was after the fall of the Taliban. Nobody looks back to the Taliban at the Taliban with anything but horror. That was the most extreme of the Islamist fundamentalist governments, and certainly the hardest not only on women but upon progressive men as well, and family life as well. So it's still one of the world's most impoverished countries. And though some progress has been made in healthcare, notably, it still has one of the highest rates of maternal mortality and infant mortality in the world. And though we talk over and over about the millions of children, especially girls, who have gone back into the schools, those figures, that's a great accomplishment, but those figures have always been exaggerated. And fewer than half of girls are in school today. And about 70% of boys are in school. But most of those children in school are concentrated in and around the major cities. And in many parts of the country, very few children are in school. In 80% of the districts in Afghanistan, there are no schools for girls after primary school. So no schools of junior high or high school level for girls. And in fact, most of the girls who are enrolled in school drop out after 1 or 2 years. The figures continue to come in, the statistics come in higher than they actually are, because the districts are paid on the basis of the number of students they enroll. But it has been common knowledge all along that great numbers of the enrolled students do not actually appear at the schools. So yes, things are a little better on some scores. But in terms of instability, in terms of the fear that people have of what may happen next, and in terms of the actual ongoing war, things are in very bad shape. In this, you know, we talk in Afghanistan about the fighting season because people can only fight in the summertime. We're coming to the end of the fighting season now. And in this past season of 2014, the Afghan National Security Forces that the United States has spent billions and billions and billions of dollars training has taken casualties twice the amount of the casualties suffered in the past 13 years by Americans. And the desertion rate is going up. The rate of soldiers in the and police within the Afghan National Security Forces we trained, who are now turning upon and killing off their supposed comrades in arms, is high. And we hear more and more about particularly squadrons of the Afghan National Army who are reaching kind of no-fight agreements, tacit agreements with their Taliban enemies and just staying on their little bases and not doing much of anything. So that's kind of the way things stand right now, 2 weeks after the inauguration of the new government.
Appreciate that answer. Thank you. What have been the largest failures of the U.S. and international community's aid and restoration programs after ousting the Taliban?
Well, we haven't actually given them much aid in the things that would have helped. The recent figures I've seen say that the United States has spent since 2002 $104 billion. That's billion with a B, dollars, in development, what's called development aid to Afghanistan. And that's separate from our military expenditures. But in that development, only $2 billion of that $104 billion has gone to humanitarian projects such as those you initially asked about, education and health care in particular. And governance, investment in good governance. The rest has gone to training up the military and police forces, the Afghan National Security Force, that is now supposed to continue to fight those battles. But, you know, I followed this Afghan National Security Force for a great many years because when I initially went to Afghanistan for many years, I was working with civilians, particularly women and kids, and also on the side teaching classes in English for Afghanistan's high school English teachers who had not had an opportunity to practice the language during the Taliban regime. And many of the men who came to those classes were men who had gone and enlisted in the Afghan National Army time and time again, because you could enlist, you would get a gun, you'd get a uniform, you'd get a paycheck, and you'd stay there for a few weeks and you'd get the training and then you'd go home. And then next time you ran short of money, you'd come back, you'd enlist under another name. And that's the way the numbers were built up over the years. I've also observed the training of the Afghan National Army and stood right next to a general who told me that if I looked out there, I would see the 6,000 men currently undergoing training, and I would count 85, and that's as many as I could see. So for years, I imagined that this was a totally invisible army. But once the U.S. decided it was going to move out and started throwing money at this army, the squads of soldiers did appear. But they until very recently, the Americans were saying that they were not fit to fight on their own. We haven't armed them substantially, so there's not much they can do anyway. And in this season of fighting, when they've taken such massive losses, they have still had the air support of American forces, and I think the British as well. And they've set new records for the amount of air support these troops are getting, but this air support will be gone pretty soon, and then we'll see what happens. So all this money that the U.S. has invested in aid has gone into something that the U.S. knows perfectly well is not able to do the job it was designed for, and in any case would have to be paid for by the United States to the tune of additional billions of dollars over at least the next decade. It's all been a fool's errand in that regard, and I'm very fearful of what will happen in the future.
One of the big issues today is that during the Taliban reign, the country's opium production was almost non-existent. However, today, since the occupation, opium and heroin production is at an all-time high. Back in 2007, 92% of all the non-pharmaceutical-grade opiates in the world, illegal, I'm talking about, originated from Afghanistan. Now, that figure is higher, with total opium production reaching 5,500 tons. But I discovered rather interestingly, back in 2010, Russia was demanding for an eradication of the poppy cultivation because of its high heroin addiction and drug overdose rate due to opiates coming over its borders. However, NATO refused to make any efforts to lessen a poppy cultivation, citing that was the nation's major source of income. And now today in the United States, we're witnessing a surge in opiate use among our youth, with cheap heroin readily available in our cities and even rural towns. And we have known for a long time that the U.S. intelligence agencies, such as the CIA, benefit greatly by supporting illegal drug trades. And we did it in the Golden Triangle during the Vietnam War and in Iran-Contra operations in Nicaragua. Can you speak about the dramatic growth in opium cultivation in Afghanistan, why the U.S. and our allies, or NATO, are making no concerted efforts to counter it?
Well, they did try, and it was a great failure. It just turned the population against us. They tried in all the wrong ways. But certainly the connection that you make between the CIA and wherever America fights wars has been very well documented, as you know, by Alfred McCoy in his books. In regard to the specific situation in Afghanistan, there was very little opium production before the U.S. came in force. And the reason that farmers turned to opium production is that there had been so much destruction of their traditional orchards, and the country grew nuts, almonds, and so on, for that was their big export crop. And all of those crops that they had grown for export had been destroyed because the orchards and the vineyards, everything was gone. And the ancient irrigation systems were also destroyed. But an easy thing for the farmers to grow was the poppy, because it grew almost by itself. And so they took up that product because they could make good money. It was also extremely good for women in the countryside, because the women could go out and tend the crops and make good money to bring into the household, which meant that they could send their children to school. The children did not have to stay home and work in the carpet industry anymore. So rural, for many reasons, heroin was a great advantage to the rural farmers. And they knew, as devout Muslims, that it was wrong for them to grow that. But this was the only way they could subsist and provide for their families. In those early days, as that poppy crop was, poppy farming was catching on across the country, the U.S. decided to go in and take it out. And we sprayed crops, resulting in the death of livestock and the illness of children. We always denied that we had done it, but everybody knew we had. We sent soldiers in to destroy the crops, which left people with winter coming on and no means of subsistence through the winter. So we turned large segments of the rural population against us by doing that. At the same time, everyone knew that it was warlords, or Taliban warlords in particular, in the South, who were behind all of this and who were really reaping the profits from the industry. It wasn't the farmers who were making big money. But, you know, former General David Richards, I think he's now Sir David Richards, who was the British commander of forces at that time, in Afghanistan, said that the reason we didn't go after the warlords who were actually behind this trade was that they would go after us. They were a real enemy. It's easier to go in and try to knock down a few poppy plants than it is to tackle the people who are making the big money and who have their own militias. So through neglect, we let it grow to the stage where it is now. And this year, higher production than ever before. They say, however, that most of that crop is not finding its way to the U.S., but rather is coming into Europe, and it's a great source of concern to the European Union. It's also become a great source of concern within Afghanistan because drug addiction in Afghanistan itself is now becoming a very big problem, and that is something quite new in Afghan history.
You've written mostly in recent years on the impact of the Afghan war upon soldiers. The average American sitting at their television watching mainstream talking parrots and amoral so-called experts are given the perception that actual warfare is only a distant land problem, not anything here at home. What happens over there has no impact over here. Yet a recent Forbes article says that over 1 million U.S. soldiers have been wounded in the Afghanistan and Iraqi wars, that is aside from the thousands killed. The cost to taxpayers for keeping each soldier in Afghanistan is about $2 million per soldier, and it's costing us $50 million to kill a single Taliban warrior. So if we kill 20 Taliban fighters in a single drone strike, it'll cost $1 billion to accomplish that. And that is only the human cost of war on our own soldiers and the U.S. economy, aside from the even greater cost of human life and destruction of the societies and cultures inflicted by our military on the civilians in these countries. But then there are the psychological costs for the soldiers who continue to serve in the Middle East and those deeply traumatized when they reenter civilian life. Every soldier will have his own individual experience that he or she brings back with him after serving in the fields and mountains of Afghanistan and Iraq. But since you have interviewed numerous soldiers, if you were to try to encapsulate the changes of the average foot soldier's views about himself or herself, our government, and the worldview, what would be its major defining features?
Well, that, again, is you've certainly outlined the problem very, very well. But the ramifications of all sorts are huge. And perhaps the most obvious one that still makes the papers in the U.S. is the high rate of suicide among veterans. A lot of it, I think, caused by the very treatment they get in the U.S. these days, which puts the emphasis on opioid, highly addictive opioid medications, instead of, you know, acknowledging the fact that war is repeated deployments to these terrible wars is going to take a great toll. We're going to be, we American citizens who are told, you know, that we're supporting our troops by just waving a flag or hanging out a yellow ribbon, are actually going to be paying enormous costs until at least the middle of this century for the care of the catastrophically wounded and deeply damaged soldiers who are returning from these wars. For the details of that, I would just refer people to my book, They Were Soldiers, if you can bear to read it. I follow what happens to the wounded and dying troops all the way through to their home ground and tell their stories there. And they are not easy stories. They were not easy stories to hear. They're not easy stories to tell or to read. But if I may make a larger point, I think that this is the price we bear at home, and our soldiers and their deeply damaged families and grieving families as well bear at home for the militarization of our country. You know, we barely have a State Department anymore. We don't believe in diplomacy anymore. We don't even have an ambassador to Norway, one of our great allies. But everything now depends upon military force. We think nothing of jumping from war to war to war. We don't always call them by the names of individual wars, but we go in and bomb, bomb, bomb. And we do this in absolute disregard of our own Constitution, which calls for an army that is a military force that will defend the country, not go on the offensive in preventative wars all around the world. And in contravention of the Constitution that provides that responsibility to the Congress to determine our wars. Our military not only is completely overblown, but seems to be the private militia of the executive branch of government. And as a result, our soldiers are being sent all around the world in our name to do things for purposes that are never disclosed or rarely disclosed, certainly not disclosed honestly to the citizenry, and the citizens have kind of fallen asleep. We take this as the normal condition of life. It is not. But until Americans stand up and try to turn this militarization around, read our own Constitution, demand our Congress take some action to put a stop to this kind of folly that we perpetrate all over the world, we're going to keep paying these costs, and our soldiers are going to be paying with their lives.
Appreciate your comments, your closing comments. I'll just add briefly my own. I believe that because of the massive influence of lobbying and corporate interest and the ease by which they can game the system to privatize the military defense intelligence apparatus, that they look at these wars not as legitimate threats to America's sovereignty and people, but rather as a profit stream. And even in your work, and you're very important, They Were Soldiers, you had views that took a look at the media concealing the actual effects of these wars on our military service personnel, and instead the continued promotion of the idea of exceptionalism and patriotism and warriorship and heroism being performed by our troops. But these journalists are not spending a day in the psyche, the family unit, or where I have filmed so many of them, in the abandonment of all. These are homeless. Over a million vets right now are homeless. You don't see them. If you went down to Florida, you'd find 16,000 living in Titusville in the woods. You'll find them under bridges. Everywhere I went in America looking for homeless vets, I found them. And yet the population was indifferent to it. When you say going into a war, are these the people you want to respect and support? They say yes. When they come back damaged, broken, with post-traumatic stress disorder. And the soldier said, after what I did or what I witnessed and could do nothing about, I couldn't live with myself. All that's hidden. None of that is spoken about. You spoke about it. So thank you for having the courage. And they were soldiers, how the wounded returned from America's wars, the untold story, to bring us those insights. And also the massive, massive corruption in Afghanistan, where billions of dollars in cash that were sent there ended up in the pockets, in the bank accounts of Karzai, his corrupt family, and their friends and associates, all with the full knowledge of our national intelligence apparatus that knows all those bank transactions, everything, every phone call, every email, every bank transaction, they have full awareness of. But they're our corrupt cronies. And so it's just one terrible, vicious game, in my opinion. I thank you for bringing it to our attention, Dr. Ann Jones.
May I wholeheartedly concur with what you just summarized, Gary? And I do think we have to look to the profiteering if we want to have some kind of explanation for why these wars continue to proliferate and why we are why our government tries to persuade us that this is in our national interest and makes us more secure. It's true that Afghanistan is judged to be one of the most corrupt countries in the world, but I was there. I was there from 2002 on, and I can tell you that where they learned that corruption was from the Americans.
Well, I think this audience at least knows that and how to get that message out to more. Thank you very much, Dr. Ann Jones, for being on with us today.
Thank you.
And that brings us up to the end of our program from Norway, Dr. Ann Jones. AnnJonesOnline.com, the website. I'm Gary Knoll. This has been the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.